Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. Doing great. Hope you've had a good week so far.
You know, it's been a terrific week so far, and I'm really really excited about the show that we've got going on this week. We get to get into some of my favorite topics, of course, that being the role that humanity plays in transforming the universe. The world transform being kind of a favorite set of buzzwords for us here on this show.
That's right. I wanted to ask you before we get too far into it, though. I wanted to ask you about the fires in Colorado. We're hearing that it's really big, bad, and ugly now. I hope it's not anywhere near you.
Well, it's not anywhere close to us. There's a whole lot of Metro Denver and then miles and miles of wilderness between us and the fires. But thank you for your concern. We're actually hoping that some changes in the weather that are expected here shortly will rectify that situation to some extent. And I should note that since we are pre-recording today's show, hopefully by the time folks are listening to this, the fires will be completely out. Something to look forward to in the future, for sure.
Absolutely. Live to see it, right?
And live to see it, for sure. And, you know, our best wishes and thoughts for all the folks whose lives and livelihoods are currently being impacted by that. It's an interesting thing. We live in a very high-tech world, but there are some things that that there are only still fairly low-tech solutions to, and fire being a really good example of that.
That's right. That's right. It's definitely an old-school threat, and it seems like wildfires have gotten worse over the last, I would say, decade or two. It's not just that we're hearing about them more often. I really believe this is one of the biggest ever, this one in Colorado.
It is. It is a truly devastating fire. Hopefully we'll be hearing some good news on that fairly soon. Well, I'll tell you what, let's spin this thing around and let's talk about areas where human beings do impact the world and where we will be impacting the future that goes far beyond fighting fires. And I think to do that, let's go ahead and we'll bring out our guest. We're very pleased to welcome Colin McInnes to Fast Forward Radio. Colin is director of the Advanced Space Concepts Laboratory at the University of Strathclyde. His work includes the investigation of families of novel spacecraft orbits and their mission applications, autonomous control of multiple spacecraft systems, and advanced space concepts. His recent work involves exploring new approaches to spacecraft orbital dynamics at extremes of spacecraft length scale as a means of supporting future space-derived products and services. He's been the recipient of national and international awards, including the Royal Aeronautical Society Pardo Space Award and the Aykroyd Stewart Propulsion Prize. More recently, he was awarded a Leonov Medal by the International Association of Space Explorers in September 2007. Over the last 10 years, McInnes' work has been funded by a diverse range of international partners, including research councils, agencies, and leading players in the aerospace industry. He currently holds an advanced investigator grant from the European Research Council. Colin McInnes, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, we're really pleased to have you with us, and I should give a little bit of background on this. After reading that introduction, folks just tuning in are going to think, oh, they're going to talk about space tonight. And in fact, we're not going to be talking about space per se. We're going to be talking about some subjects that relate to that, but we're talking about an article that you published recently on the Spiked Online website on the subject of a very provocative title, Bringing Dead Matter to Life. and the role that humanity plays in that, and the role that we're going to be playing in the future in doing that. So I wonder if we can just start off by you talking a little bit about what that means. How did dead matter come to life in the first place? First at the molecular level, and then you describe sort of at the planetary level.
Sure. Yeah, I guess the article itself, Phil, I mean, it was a kind of response to kind of frustrations, if you like, with some of the cultural viewpoints which we see just now, which are pretty kind of misanthropic. And the article was just an attempt to take a kind of big picture view, long term view of humanity, kind of where it's come from and where it's going, and maybe to kind of celebrate human achievements in what humanity actually does. As a long-term enterprise. I guess the kind of starting point is that all of us are the kind of unlikely products of dead matter. Some time ago in the Greek distant past, individual atoms and molecules were able to form replications in themselves. And in doing so through DNA, they were able to store and to replicate information. And that led, of course, to a self-organization to the extent that that modern conscious thinking humans are quite literally dead matter, which is self-organized and come to life and is walking the planet. So that in itself is, of course, an extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary achievement of the dead matter of the Earth, literally achieving self-awareness through these random steps. And I think, you know, each of us is incredibly important and valuable in that sense when we think of just what it is we represent ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, I wonder if when we talk about dead matter coming to life, it's very interesting in the article you talk about how that kind of dynamic principle that humanity represents has come to embed itself in kinds of matter that weren't necessarily all that dynamic in the past, metals and those kinds of things. Is it fair to extend your idea to say that all of the information that we're kind of embedding into the into our environment is a further extension of matter being brought to life?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, unthinking kind of organic biology, you know, it processes mostly, you know, atoms of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. But you know, through thinking humans and the human enterprise, you know, we're able to process, you know, metals and minerals in making structures, both of bigger and bigger scales, and also in finer and finer spatial resolution. So, you know, everything from kind of nanotechnology up to skyscrapers. And it's that kind of self-organization, which I find absolutely fascinating, that, you know, we ourselves have self-organized out of dead matter. But, you know, we're now self-organizing, you know, more dead matter of the Earth into these, you know, large-scale and very small-scale structures.
Is it fair to push it back even further to, well, you know, even the beauty of the periodic table? There's organization there and space itself and... And the laws of nature that underlie everything. I mean, that I guess we're talking organization even further back, that and each thing builds upon the last paradigm.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, in terms of the natural world through the laws of physics, there's a structure there through the laws of physics which gives organization in the kind of wider universe, which is seen. You know, stars and planets, but the advent of humanity to me was almost like a kind of phase change, if you like, in that the level of complexity.
One of the terms you use in the
which is being embedded in dead matter. So
I'm sorry, Colin. I talked over you there for a minute. Go ahead and complete what you were saying.
I was finished, Phil.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say one of the terms that you use in the article is Anthropocene. This interesting notion of we've entered this period of evolution where the geological era that we're in now is the one in which humanity is kind of driving what occurs on the planet. When I was reading that, I was reminded of a book, The Phenomenon of Man by Teilhard de Chardin. Are you familiar with that book by any chance?
No, I'm not. It's a
book. Okay, he was actually a Jesuit priest and an evolutionary biologist. He wrote writing, I think, back in the 1940s. And I'm not sure, but he may be the person who came up with that term, Anthropocene. And he talks in terms of evolution in exactly those kinds of terms, where we go from species level evolution to kind of planetary evolution with humanity and our what he talks about is the hominization of the planet. We can take it from the French and make it humanization, I think, of the planet occurring through our technology. Do you think that's an overreach, or would you agree with that in some sense the planet is becoming sort of humanized by us?
Oh yeah, I think it's been humanized by our actions, since modern humans emerged. I mean, back to the advent of agriculture, which we began to rearrange nature more to our liking, and through the Industrial Revolution that process has accelerated. The idea of the Anthropocene, it's seen in some quarters as an extremely dangerous advent where human activity has such a big impact in flows of material and energy in the planet. But it's something which I think we should really welcome. It gives us a chance, firstly, to decouple human needs from the environment for the benefit of humanity. But it also gives us an opportunity to direct the path of nature in the future, and to perhaps actually to prevent, in the long term, to prevent the natural catastrophes which have had a catastrophic effect in the biosphere in the past, and everything from asteroid impacts to ice ages.
One of the things I like to say is that we are the only species living on the planet that knows it's a species and that knows it lives on a planet. And it seems that that kind of extraordinary position that puts us in, and the kind of extraordinary, on the one hand, responsibility that gives us, and at the same time, the extraordinary capability that suggests that we might have to act in a positive and favorable way for the good of the planet, is something that is completely missed out on by, I think, what you describe as sort of standard green thinking. That notion that we could do some tremendous good for the rest of the planet doesn't seem to hit home.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's again, if you back over the natural history of the planet, then nature has stumbled from one catastrophe to another without any help from human intervention in the past. Again, everything from asteroid impacts to ice ages, and I think it's Freeman Dyson back in the 1970s that said that there's the point you make, Phil, that we as self-aware thinking humans, with an array of technological innovations at our hand, that we have a responsibility to use those as caretakers for the planet, not to destroy it, but to use your innovation to give it meaning and context, which only comes about through human activity.
Colin, would you say that it's fair to say that as far as we know, human beings are now, at this point, the primary means by which the universe brings dead matter to life? We're kind of the drivers of that process at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's a whole other topic of intelligent life elsewhere. But I guess based on what we know and understand just now, then it does appear at least that the human enterprise is the sole driver for bringing self-organized conscious life to the universe. And again, I mean, if that is in fact the case, then it's a pretty awesome responsibility on us as a species. And also, again, it gives the most fantastic meaning to each of our lives if humanity really is that unique.
It really does say something significant about us as a species, and it does give us kind of an additional role for each of our lives. That's kind of the function that humanity is serving. One of the ideas that really struck me in your essay was this notion of ideas, how ideas sort of become the world. Ideas having this kind of transformative effect on the planet. How do ideas become embedded into our environment, and how are they actually transforming the world?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point, Phil, is that the transformation of dead matter into through technological innovation, it's all about ideas. I mean, you know, the human enterprise is nothing other than better ideas. And, we can store the ideas, we can communicate the ideas, we can pass them into the future, the ideas can evolve. And it's through the implementation of those ideas through technology and through engineering, which we can transform the planet, which we're turning, again, either dead matter into conscious life, or metals and minerals into nanotech products, or aircraft or rockets. Outcome from human evolution of getting to the stage where our ideas can have such a profound impact.
There's been a history of moving us away from the middle of things. We learned that we weren't the center of the universe, or the center even of the solar system, and that our sun's sort of unremarkable and on all this. But some of these ideas it tend to move us back to the middle and place this responsibility back on us, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, I guess it comes down to, if humanity is the only self-organized, conscious life in our locality at least, then it puts us in the center stage, and it also puts a burden of responsibility on our shoulders as well, in order that, again, the human enterprise, this kind of self-organization, can continue into the deep future.
It really is quite remarkable when you think about it, this idea that information in our heads, that things that we imagine, the products of our reveries or maybe our very careful, conscious, studied thought, can ultimately become manifest in the world. That it almost sounds like you're talking about something magical or metaphysical, but of course it's not the case at all. It's how we work and how the world works. But when you think about something as familiar to us now as like a smartphone or an iPad, and how at one point that kind of technology was an idea in someone's head, and now it's this pervasive fact of life, and something that we all deal with all the time, deeply embedded into our lives, deeply embedded into how the world works, how the economy works. And that's true not just of that particular piece of technology, but virtually you look around the room you're in, everything you see started out as a thought, started out as someone imagining, well, this might be a good design for a lampshade, or the building that you're in, right? So somebody drew up a plan and said, here, this might work. What started as information, what started as synapses firing in the brain become these actual pieces of the world, pieces that we interact with and that have these profound effects on what we do. It really makes you think about how careful we need to be about what we're thinking about, particularly if we're planning to act on the things that we're thinking about.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of that ideas, I mean, there's the ideas which we pass into the future through the past through books and writing, and others can take up these ideas, chew them over, improve on them, and we have this continuous cycle of innovation, which drives forward the human enterprise into the future. And I guess it's sort of kind of continuum as well, because there's the dead matter which self-organized into humanity, and we're now embedding that complexity back into dead matter. So again, the smartphone, the silicon, the aluminium which makes up the smartphone, that's dead matter dug out of the ground, which we are embedding our ideas in to make these useful technological products. An example which I tend to use in talks to school kids is, again, the smartphone one, but it's the little blue dot in Google Maps and pointing out that if you have a GPS chip, your sat nav in your smartphone, then the little blue dot in Google Maps, that's the space industry.
Mm.
That little blue dot. Because that little blue dot is the top of a very large pyramid of several dozen GPS satellites, each of which was designed by teams of thousands of engineers, each of which was launched by a Delta II rocket, all to give you the little blue dot in Google Maps. And we tend to lose sight of that. We tend to lose sight of the fantastic innovations which have been put into the hands of individuals. And again, I mean, another consequence of technical innovation is this kind of mass democratization, if you like. So, the services or products which were only available to the very few in the past are now available to the many in the smartphone or sat nav in your smartphone. Is a very good example of that. The other example is for technical innovation is the process of dematerialization. And again, for the communications, we've gone from subsea cables with countless tons of iron and copper in the late 1800s with absolutely lousy bandwidth through the electric telegraph. And we've dematerialized that into wireless communications, reducing material throughputs, reducing costs, and improving performance. And it's a societal benefit because it's a mass democratization of access to technology and services. And it's an environmental benefit as well because we're using less material and we're using it much, much more efficiently than we did in the past.
Colin, one of the things you talk about in the essay is this move from high entropy to lower entropy solutions and how that seems to factor into the impact that humanity has on the world and can have on the world. And I wonder how this process that you just described of dematerialization, how does that factor in when looking at what we do from an entropy standpoint?
Yeah, I guess we're building more and more structure and complexity into matter, particularly as we engineer matter down to finer and finer scales. Set more thermodynamics in that process, we generate waste heat. In the same way that in biological systems, where solar energy is turned into complex biological structures, and the waste heat is radiated to cold space through the leaf canopy in rainforests, for example. So it's the same physics is at work in the natural world of how complex structures evolve, and we're doing the same again as thinking conscious humans.
Following up to that idea, how far do you think dematerialization will take us? I know one of the statements that you say that obviously on Fast Forward Radio we have to get to that you make in your essay is that we should not hold our breath waiting for the singularity. So do you see that as not a likely possibility or simply something that we shouldn't is that more of a caution that we don't put all of our eggs in one outcome basket for the future?
I think the point I was trying to make, Phil, in the article was really that it's something we should be, kind of fairly relaxed about. To me, that the great singularity that occurred on the Earth was the advent of thinking humans. Mm. The advent of humanity was the singularity of biological evolution. There was this fantastic phase change in the ability of the dead Earth to self-organize material through thinking humans. So, we've seen that singularity type event, burst forth on the surface of the Earth in the past, and it's us. Each individual human, we are the smart matter, the self-replicating smart matter of this singularity of biological evolution. So, the idea of a kind of future, phase change and self-organization, then sure, yeah. I mean, who knows? It may not occur. I think we just need to be relaxed about it, and we have to. Again, it's come back to, valuing humanity for what we are, that we're the smart matter, that we're the singularity in the face of the Earth at present.
I really like that idea. I like that conception of us as the singularity. And when you look at it that way, kind of going back to one of the points Stephen was making earlier, just as you can find these different structures embedded in the natural world. You can also find examples of major discontinuous world-changing, you couldn't have predicted what happened beyond it, singularity-type type changes that have occurred throughout evolution. One of the big ones being when we split off, well, the ancestors that became us split off from the ancestors that became chimps. That's one I always talk about, right? It's like when humans became humans and it became this thinking species that eventually started doing, you know, podcasts and things like that. That was right. That was huge. But there actually are others of that are, if not as big, arguably kind of in the same ilk. When you look at the invention of language, right, that's often listed as one of those, and perhaps that was inevitable once we became who we are. When you look at the move from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to an agricultural norm, and then from there to industrialization, and then again from industrialization to information, this kind of rapid progress, or people swing it all the way back, and the one we started talking about here is the emergence of life itself. Obviously, perhaps the biggest singularity of them all. Do you think that that in your view, if you were a betting man, that next one is coming? That there are changes ahead as big as the ones that have come before, or do you think that we're not to twist what you just said, but that the presence of this thinking species that we are is kind of the pinnacle, and everything else is just what sort of follows naturally from that?
I sincerely hope it's not the pinnacle. I'm sure that as we kind of fast forward into the future, we see again these kind of phase changes of technological innovation, which will rapidly change the way that we live our lives. I guess one kind of concern for me, which has been kind of mooted, kind of elsewhere as well, is that the pace of innovation. Some argue that we're living through an age of technological marvels of smartphones and iPads and podcasts and so on. Another view, which says that actually since about the kind of early 1970s, the pace of innovation has actually flattened out, quite considerably. Looking at things like productivity figures, they tend to flatten out in the early 1970s. One of the arguments goes that we've kind of eaten the low-hanging fruit of technical innovation. So from steam engines to internal combustion engines to gas turbines, that we're reaching are flattering out in terms of, for example, power conversion efficiency. I'm not hugely convinced myself about that argument. I think in some cases there has been a kind of plateauing of innovation over the kind of past few decades, but I'm pretty sure that will be more of an inflection point in the things which will pick up in future. And also as we mix together a whole range of technical innovations from communication technologies to biotech, and there'll be completely unsuspected and kind of serendipitous discoveries which we'll make as we piece things together. Which I'm sure will change the world in the future in the same way that the advent of steam power or semiconductors did in the past.
Let me run a possible definition of the singularity by you, Colin, and see what you think about it. I've often heard it described as the moment at which greater than human intelligence arrives, but my problem with that is that in so many ways, computers are already more intelligent than we are in certain limited certain ways. The best chess players on the planet are now computers, not humans. And there are many other examples of that. I've often thought perhaps maybe we should redefine it as the moment we have self-recursive improving intelligence. Intelligence that's actually can build upon itself to make itself more intelligent over and over again, and it just blasts off ahead of us. Perhaps that's the singularity. I don't know. You guys have a thought on that?
Sure. I guess that's an interesting definition, Stephen. I guess one of the kind of issues I have with the kind of idea of the singularity per se is that it's never going to be single event or some single moment in time I think if in terms of the, if you think of the singularity, these kind of phase changes of innovation, if we've talked about in the past and all the way back to agriculture, you know, I mean, some of them are kind of fairly slow burning. Some of them have been very, very rapid, you know, internet communications and so on. So I think the kind of idea of the kind of technological singularity, you know, I think it's one of these things we'll maybe recognise it from the other side, and it's hard to actually predict what it will look like from just now. But I think, yeah, I mean, that idea of the self-recursive improving intelligence, certainly, you know, one, I think, very useful definition of what a technological singularity could look like. But I suspect in practice there'll be a range of technical innovations, maybe several of which will overlap at roughly the same time and will give us a feeling of a very rapid technological process, but won't actually, you know, recognise that until we're on the other side of it. You know, a little bit like in, you know, the late 1800s, the early 1900s, of the whole revolution in electrical and chemical technology, which, you know, at the time was an absolutely transformative set of innovations for society, for, you know, everything from, you know, electrical communications, electric lighting, you know, powered flight, all that happening in a relatively short few decades. But I guess it wasn't really until the other side of that, you know, later on in the 20th century, perhaps, that we can recognise that kind of late industrial revolution for what it was. So, again, I think it'll be the same with any future technological singularities that will be on the far side of it, will recognise what it was and when it happened.
I like your definition, Stephen, although I would have to say that just to clarify one point, when you talk about recursively self-improving intelligence, you mean in another substrate, because surely humanity is already that.
Well, we can teach each other new things, but I wonder if I do believe that our IQ is a little bit flexible. Okay, if you can start with an IQ at this level, and through discipline and hard work, you can build on that somewhat. But I think there's probably an upper limit that we tend not to get past, and I'm talking about something that would obviously not have those limits.
Oh, okay, yeah, like within a given intelligence, because I guess what my refinement would have to do with across the generations, we're recursively self-improving. But
we don't have to make the same mistakes that were made 100 years ago. We already know about those mistakes.
Right, but you're talking about an intelligence, one being, right, that gets smarter and smarter and smarter itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like me.
Yeah.
Kind of like me.
Yeah. If I can add to that, guys, I think, you know, in terms of the, you know, the kind of recursively improving intelligence. Okay, I guess you could imagine that happening in software.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at, again, the way in which humanity has used tools. You know, one of the tools which I use in my research is Mathematica, which is a symbolic manipulation program for mathematics. Now, when I was doing my doctoral studies in the late 1980s, you know, I had to use, you know, pencil and paper mathematical manipulation, and it was very tedious and made lots of mistakes. And now I can do the same thing literally by hitting the return key on my laptop and using mathematical manipulation tools. Now, that doesn't make me any smarter or any better a mathematician, but it sure as hell improves my productivity as a researcher. So I think the way in which the human intelligence can use more and more sophisticated tools, it helps us to achieve so much more. And I think we'll see more of that in the future. That is kind of and also the interface between the human and the machine starting to blur a little bit. We have this, you know, bottleneck of the QWERTY keyboard to get through just now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The idea that we've all gotten immensely more intelligent over the last few decades, we don't keep that into all of it, or maybe even the lion's share of that intelligence in our heads. It's sitting someplace else. And Stephen, I come to think of it, that's one of your one of your frequent claims, is that you count all of Google as part of your own mental machinery, right?
And, you know, I did even before I had a smartphone, but certainly now that I have a smartphone and all of it's available to me at any time, at any moment, you know, why not claim it as part of my intelligence, right?
Absolutely. Well, and swinging it back to the notion where I think we're all in agreement that that progress may have slowed down. I think that there are measures that can show that, but I think the real problem with that is maybe sample size. We're talking about too short of a period of time to actually realize whether things have slowed down significantly or whether they are continuing to speed up or whether they're going at the same pace. But I also think that doesn't take that piece of it into consideration. This like amazing like synthesis that's going on right now between human beings and machine intelligence. Now, I'm not talking necessarily about us becoming cyborgs or anything like that, but just the simple fact that we've got huge leverage over information that we didn't used to have, and an ability to be, Colin, as you said, much more productive with information than we ever were before.
Yeah, I think there's the kind of productivity gains. Also, of course, you mentioned the example of Google, what a fantastic tool, but you're swamped by colossal quantities of data, and I think we'll see that in the future in terms of the interfaces which we use to data streams. Is that the interface will become much more finely tuned and customized to our needs, so we can kind of make sense of this huge flows of information which we now have at our fingertips. And if we can do that, and if we can use electronic communications to share our ideas, then the pieces are in place for the next kind of wave of technological innovation. In terms of innovation, the kind of slowdown or this kind of argument, kind of a stagnation of innovation over the past few decades. One of the things which I see as a researcher is that there's more and more focus now, of course, in on applications of research, which is all in good, but I think we've lost a little bit along the way the kind of cultural sense that scientific research is a random walk, and that we have to be able to afford to make mistakes in that random walk and learning from failures. It's like an evolutionary process. So that kind of serendipitous nature of scientific discovery and research, I think we're kind of losing sight a little bit of that, and that's something which we have to maybe swing back to, is to kind of scatter the seeds more and more widely to see where the innovations of tomorrow are going to take root.
Okay, good thought. And let's think of that idea just for a minute, because one of the ideas, kind of the flip side of not holding our breath to the singularity that you mentioned, is that in your essay you said that we don't really need to lose any sleep worrying over the gray goo scenario. Is that because innovation has slowed? Is that because we would never do anything that silly? Why don't we need to worry that we're going to build technology that's going to dismantle us?
Oh, I think yeah. I mean, the grey goo comment in the article was always a recognition that that we are the grey goo. humanity is a self-replicating smart matter, and how wonderful we are for that. There's always risks in terms of any technical innovation, and it's as we need to grow the complexity of our technical innovations, then it's incumbent upon us to be consider all those risks. But I believe just now we're swinging far too much in the opposite direction in terms of the application of the precaution principle to new technologies, which we see from everything from GM agriculture through to nuclear power. And we have to swing back the other direction, and we have to loosen up a little bit in our view of the future and how we deal with innovation.
I think you used a really important word when we first started talking earlier. You talked about this kind of misanthropic thinking. Let me ask you something. In your view, where does this anti-human mindset come from? Why it seems that the press and much of popular culture, and I would think just a good deal of our in the U.S. anyway, a good deal of our like government type thinking is all sort of begins with the premise that humanity is a very risky proposition, that we're out doing bad things, and that we represent this huge risk for the future. I mean, I think it, when you say that we're the gray goo, I think a lot of people look at it that way, and they see it exactly that way, that we are this, you know, this technology run amok, right? We're this monster that threatens to destroy the planet, to eat the planet. Where does that mindset come from, and what do you think we can do about that?
Well, yeah, I guess the question of where it's come from, it's a good question to ask, and I'm not entirely sure I have kind of all the answers for that. I mean, there's the rise of the kind of mainstream kind of environmental green thinking, and while I personally wouldn't disagree with much of the aims of having a clean environment for the future. I mean, who would disagree with that?
Right.
But the mechanism in which that's achieved is something I would disagree with. So, for example, there's the mainstream green thinking is dead against nuclear power, whereas from my background as a kind of physicist turned engineer, and I'm sure to many other engineers, nuclear power is the cleanest, greenest form of energy which we have, and is one which can be developed into the far future, providing copious quantities of clean, reliable energy from small, compact power plants. I mean, again, you can't get much greener than nuclear power in that sense. But in terms of the kind of misanthropic view of humanity, again, it's a difficult one. I think it's something which has slowly grown up over the kind of past maybe kind of 20 years or so, and it's very corrosive, in my view. Again, the view which I put forward in the article, which is that humanity has been a fantastic enterprise for and each of every one of us, of dead matter, which is walking the planet, is living, thinking humans, and the potential which we have for the future. I think it's a message which we really have to get across to overcome this really kind of grey gloom view of the future which we have just now. And of course, it is the evidence contradicts that view. If you look over the 20th century and back further since the Industrial Revolution, life expectancy, literacy, all those metrics are improving decade on decade. So, in terms of the again, other people have made this as well. If you were to choose when to be alive in human history, then now is the best possible time in terms of your potential life outcomes. And we've kind of lost the upside of that message somewhere. Partly, I guess, it's the whole issue of kind of climate change, which has been a big issue in popular culture over the past 10, 20 years. But of course, the way to deal with these issues is through human innovation.
Some of the green folks would have us abandon all technology, as if that would be a better idea.
Yeah, I think there's different shades of green. From the kind of technological progressive green through to the very misanthropic deep green views which are out there. My concern with the kind of mainstream green thinking is that perhaps it's not against technological innovation, but it's selective in technological innovation. So, yes to wind turbines, but no to nuclear power, for example. As soon as we start to set these hard boundaries and these hard constraints on technological innovation, then we're bypassing a whole range of innovations which are both socially and environmentally progressive.
I like the point that this is the best time in history to be alive. I think that's an excellent point.
It's the theme of our show, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look from the present back, there is no better time to be alive. Now, there actually is a better time probably to be alive, which is the future, because things are likely to continue in that same direction. But that hypothetical question that people ask sometimes, if you could live in any other era other than the one you're currently in, and people come up with really romanticized answers to that question, I really think that the truth of it is that some people firmly believe they'd like to live in a previous era of human history, but what they would really like would be to live in a movie about that, because they have no idea what life was really like in any of these any of these previous eras. I certainly wouldn't want to go back and live any time before dentistry existed, or like, you know, anesthesia, or, you know, indoor plumbing, or, you know, any of those kinds of things. If that makes me a big wimp, you know, I can live with that. But I know that our descendants will look back on this time as being, you know, brutal and primitive and horrible in ways that we can't even imagine.
Yeah, I think there's the kind of view that a very romanticized view of the past, and again, I think it's one of my, you know, concerns with the idea of the kind of mainstream green thinking and the idea of the sustainability that you know, we can live in some kind of, you know, romantic kind of quasi, you know, pastoral lifestyle, you know, with little in the way of material consumption, maybe something akin to, you know, the kind of late 1800s, early 1900s, but somehow we'll still have the internet and modern healthcare. In fact, we know it, we won't. You know, we'll have, you know, we'll have, you know, 19th century healthcare and 19th century communications technology. So again, you know, innovations are so strongly connected together and so strongly networked that you know, we can't really kind of pick and choose.
Exactly. Well, with the few minutes we have left, I want to get to a little bit deeper of an exploration of this idea of sustainability, because I think this is a really important point that you make, and we've touched on it here several times as we've been talking. But fundamentally, what is the problem with any call for equilibrium, or what do you think is flawed about notions of sustainability as they currently exist?
Well, yeah, I mean, that idea of sustainability, I mean, it has many different interpretations. One of the interpretations, as you rightly point out, is the idea of an economy or society which is in balance and is in equilibrium. But, you know, if you look at the natural world, you know, the whole natural world and humans themselves are highly non-equilibrium processes. So, you know, the only place it's in equilibrium is the moon, and it's dead. You know, life on Earth is in a highly non-equilibrium state. Huge flows of energy in matter, both in the natural world and in human society, and it's that highly non-equilibrium state which gives the sheer richness both to the natural world, you know, in human civilization and culture, and the idea that we're in somehow some kind of, you know, long-term equilibrium. I mean, you know, inevitably that would lead to both, you know, cultural, technological stagnation, you know, ossification of human society, and we would forego some of the fantastic opportunities of the future, which human ingenuity and human innovation can deliver for us.
Along those lines, I wonder if goals should almost be a kind of a hopscotch, a kind of a leaping from one unsustainable model to the next, that we'll never actually arrive in a truly sustainable model, but we recognize that that nothing that we do lasts forever anyway. That as long as we understand that the arrow is pointing in the right direction and we're making progress towards sustainability, that's probably the a more realistic way of going about it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in the past, we've talked about before, we've seen, you know, waves of technological innovation where new ideas, you know, have killed off old ideas and processes and industry, and inevitably that will continue, you know, into the future. But, you know, part of that, you know, can be a decoupling of human needs from the natural environment. You know, whether that's people, you know, moving from, you know, agricultural lifestyles, you know, into high-tech cities, which is, you know, releasing more land back to nature. You know, whether it's using nuclear energy to substitute for fossil fuels, or whether it's using, you know, GM agriculture to improve the agricultural productivity of land without having to annex more land from nature for food production. You know, all of these are both immense societal benefits and environmental benefits as well. And come back to the issue which I have with the idea of sustainability is that some of the ideas which are put forward as being sustainable to me are anything but. So, for example, for renewable energy, having to collect, you know, diffuse and intermittent, you know, energy from the wind, the waves, or the sun requires, you know, vast quantities of land and materials compared to, you know, using compact nuclear reactors, where uranium or thorium have the most immense energy density, which we can tap into to provide an copious quantities of cheap, clean energy into the distant future. So it's somewhat ironic that some of the technological solutions which are presented as being sustainable in some ways are anything but.
That is a great irony. It just goes to show you that it's one of those, when I use a word, it means what I want it to mean, not necessarily what anyone else says that it means. Final question here, and this is one of my favorite points that you make in the essay. Let me ask you this way: Why does the fate of humanity and of the planet depend on humanity overcoming our lack of ambition?
The fate of humanity and the fate of the planet, of course, are closely intertwined. In terms of the fate of the planet, well, again, if we look back through the natural history, then you know we see that the planet has stumbled, you know, from one catastrophe to the next over kind of geological timescales. Again, whether it's been through asteroid impacts or ice ages, and we're now at the point with human civilization and technological innovation where we can actually intervene in those processes which have been hugely destructive to the planet in the past. So the idea of, you know, deflecting, for example, near-Earth asteroids, there's a clear benefit to humanity of having the technological capability to do so. But it's of huge importance to the future of the planet as well, because in the past, when the sinking humans weren't here, then such impacts caused catastrophic damage to the biosphere in the past. Similarly with ice ages as well, in the future, the 21st century, we may see geoengineering being used perhaps to clip the top of the pulse of carbon, which is working its way from the ground to the atmosphere and back to the ground again in the future. The same technologies can control these large, long-term climatic changes in the Earth, which in the past had fairly catastrophic effects. So I think we're just kind of waking up, if you like, from our slumber as a civilization in terms of the tools which we have and the scale in which we can apply those tools. And, if we don't have the ambition to use them, if we don't have the ambition to continue the process of innovation, then it's a very bleak future both for human civilization and a bleak future for the planet as well.
Kind of the end game for the whole question of sustainability. Yeah, what's ultimately sustainable versus our long-term survival. And we represent, ironically enough, for those who see us only as a risk or a threat, we represent the greatest hope for ourselves, but also for the planet. I like the end of, I think it's Kurzweil's The Age of Spiritual Machines. I think it's that earlier book, not The Singularity is Near, where his timeline of future events kind of, he hits an ellipsis, and then it ends with the descendants of humanity decide the fate of the universe, basically, is what happens. Now that is no lack of ambition right there.
No, absolutely not. And that's the wonderful position we're in just now. And so, we talked about earlier the fact that there's been no better time to be alive than the present. And the ability now for fairly reliable access to space by humans and their machines, and this realization that the universe, at least as far as we can see, is dead and absent of self-organized life, then we have this amazing opportunity to spread the self-organized life through space, literally bringing life to dead matter.
And that kind of brings us back to where we started. All right. Well, listen, I think we're out of time now. Stephen, did you have any other questions? I was kind of stepping on you there, I think.
Oh, no, not at all. It's sure been a pleasure to get to visit with you, Colin. You have an outstanding blog we want to direct people to, and continue to watch and read ourselves.
Well, yeah, no, Phil, Stephen, it's been a real pleasure for me too. Really, really enjoyed talking to you. Very, very stimulating conversation. And thanks for asking me onto your show.
All right. Well, let's plan on having you back again sometime in the near future, and we'll talk about space as well.
Great. Yeah.
The name of the blog is Perpetual Motion. Is that correct?
That's the blog title is Perpetual Motion, as in the perpetual motion of ideas and of innovation.
Exactly. Oh, you're not selling a perpetual motion machine then? Is that right?
No. I would have been tongue in cheek playing words. But the URL, it's colinmcinnis.blogspot.co.uk.
And we'll be sure and put that link up on the Speculist as well as in the show notes over on Blog Talk Radio. Well, once again, Colin, thank you very much.
No, it's a real pleasure. Thanks very much, guys.
Okay, Stephen. Well, that's going to do it for this week. What have you got going for us music this week?
Well, since this is a canned show, Phil, I'm going to keep my cards close to my chest until tomorrow night when I actually roll the music. And I will tell the live audience to what the music is at that time. And it's what I'm trying to do, Phil, is I'm trying to make sure that you actually tune in tomorrow to listen to it live.
Well,
so,
from where we sit, it's actually more than tomorrow. It's actually a week from tomorrow. But
okay.
I will look into the future and find that out. You know, it's interesting. That's kind of cool. You're being kind of coy, but even you don't know what the music is. Isn't that right, Steve?
Not yet. Who knows? It might be something really awesome that is posted at Music Alley. That's the place I like to go find this great stuff. It might be something really great posted, the day before. And so I always I try to have a few things ready to go on music, but, I will always shove that aside if something great hits us at the last minute. So.
All right. Well, folks, enjoy the music. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. We'll be back again next week at the regular time. Love having you all with us. Look forward to talking with you again. And until next time, live to see it. Now you choose another.